Hello and welcome back to Journal Club. You're here today with Dr. Laura Gange, Jess Guy, who is very nearly doctor, and Dr. Kristen Summer. Hey guys.
Hello.
Hello.
Today we are covering a new paper which was recently published. It's so new that it's in, I've got it printed as a journal preproof, which means that it hasn't quite finished its like final round of formatting, so it's very new. And it's called Implementation of Behavioral Interventions for Infant Sleep Problems in Real-World Settings. It's authored by Michelle Kahn, Natalie Barnett, and Michael Gradizar, who we're going to talk about in just a little while. But the first thing we're going to talk about is what this paper was actually about. So their objectives were to compare the real-world frequency, timing, duration, difficulty, and helpfulness of their three infant behavioral sleep intervention approaches: unmodified extinction, also known as cry it out; modified extinction, also known as FERBA; intermittent responding, intermittent comforting, space soothing, all of those kinds of things; and parental presence, which is where the parent stays in the room continuously but does not provide any additional support to the infant. That's generally known as something like camping it out, or I can't remember the other one, but that's generally what that is. So they were going to examine the effectiveness and safety of these approaches by comparing infant sleep, parent sleep, daytime sleepiness, depression, and parent-infant bonding between parents who had not implemented these interventions. So they got 2,090 parents of US infants aged between 3 and 18 months. The parents completed online questionnaires regarding their infant sleep, their own sleep, their daytime sleepiness, depression levels, and parent-infant bonding. It was their infant sleep was assessed via objective, albeit exploratory, auto video somnography data obtained from the 14 days prior to the survey completion. Now, auto video somnography is a really long word for what the NANET monitor does. So this research has been supported by, and one of the authors on the paper is a NANET researcher. So this is really exploring the use of the monitor to assess infant sleep quality, infant wakefulness, infant sleep duration, all that kind of stuff. They found that 64% of parents reported implementing a behavioral sleep intervention, so FERBA, cry it out, or camping out. Unmodified and modified extinction, so FERBA and cry it out, were rated as significantly more difficult to implement compared with parental presence, but also is more helpful, shorter, and quicker to show improvements. The average age of the babies was 5.3 months, which is slightly less than the World Health Organization's recommendation of sleep training being enacted after 6 months of age. So this is a much younger population than we would expect. Infant nighttime sleep was longer and more consolidated in the unmodified and modified extinction groups compared with the parental presence and no behavioral sleep intervention groups. No differences were found between the behavioral sleep intervention groups in parent sleep, sleepiness, depression, or parent-infant bonding. Conclusions are: implementation of behavioral sleep interventions outside clinical settings is pervasive, it happens a lot, and occurs earlier than generally recommended. Well, there you go, it's in there. Unmodified and modified extinction were associated with longer and more consolidated infant sleep. We will talk about the specifics of what longer and more consolidated means in just a moment. Despite concerns regarding the potential harm of behavioral sleep interventions, implementation of these approaches was not linked with negative outcomes, providing additional evidence for their safety and effectiveness. And that was me reading the abstract, if you didn't notice. I had a few like deviations. I'm sure you noticed which ones those were. But that is what the abstract says in full. That's what they say they looked at, how they did it, and what they found and concluded. So their major finding is that the auto video somnography, the observations by the NANET video monitor, showed that babies who had a behavioral sleep intervention, particularly the unmodified and modified extinction groups, so even the babies who have been slept trained using a method like cry it out, where the parents stayed in the room but didn't touch the baby, they found that they slept longer and more consolidated. That was their major finding. Jess, do you want to kick us off with what that difference in number of awakenings and length of time sleeping was?
Yeah, so what I noted down, and correct me if you read something else or there was more to it, but this is what I got was 10, so overnight sleep total duration in modified and unmodified extinction was around 10 and a half hours on average. And the range was slightly smaller. I think I'd have to go back to the graph, but I think it would have been 9.5 to 11 or something like that. So it was a smaller range. In parental presence and no behavioral sleep intervention, it was around 10 hours on average. And the range was a little larger. So, you know, maybe plus or minus 2 hours instead of plus or minus 1 hour. It looked like it was about 3 versus 4 awakenings for those same different groups, modified and unmodified, and then parental presence or no behavioral sleep interventions. So 3 for the sleep trained, modified and unmodified, 4 for not sleep trained or parental presence, and 1 versus 2 crib visits. So 1 in modified and unmodified, 2 in parental presence and no sleep intervention in 3 to 11 months, but then virtually no difference in crib visits by 12 to 18 months age group. Is that what you have?
Yeah, I was just pulling up the graph to have a look at exactly what you're talking about.
So the table, it basically varies from 9 hours and 35 minutes to 9 hours and 59 minutes to for the unmodified sleep training. So I didn't get that it goes all the way to 11 hours. I don't know if that's on the graph, but I pulled the numbers from the table.
Yeah, so the graph.
I think I was trying to kind of line it up because it's a box plot, so you are definitely more accurate there. I didn't look at the table.
Yes, but I did look at the table and the graphs, and you are correct, Jess, that it does look like the graphs are a whole hour higher than the table. So I don't know if it's just a bit of misplotting or inaccuracy, but you are right that it did look that way.
This is one of the things I wanted to talk about, because if we look at the graphs, and actually, can I just ask, for me, Kristen's frozen. Jessica, do you see her move?
Yes, I'm seeing Kristen move.
Okay. All right. So in case you're showing your
I am not.
Your screen, because I can't see you move. But I have a problem with why and how they did outliers here. Just because, okay. And so that's where the difference of hours is coming from. Because if you look at the plots, you will see that the outliers are these little dots, right? But why are they outliers? So for everyone listening, usually outliers are, you know, in statistics, you will have the average, the majority of the population, and you will remove the people on the side. But I would say that clinically, you tend to remove, to have outliers if you consider that they're not normal or like they're a mistake. And in this case, if you look at the plots, there are tons of outliers that, you know, make it much a wider range, which is what us three would say about infant sleep, which is very variable. But because they wanted to keep it more, and I guess they wanted to get a difference, they remove all these data points and say, oh, those are outliers and we don't count them. And I have a big problem with that already, because if you look at the, you know, even the average of awakenings, you get a similar range. Of course, you might have different numbers, but still, it's like, why are those kids considered outliers?
I do remember seeing that they said they Windsorized outliers. Where is it?
They said 0.2% and 0.5%, something like that.
And what is that in? So 2,090 participants times 0.02% is 41 participants in the 0.2%. And 104 participants. Okay, that is a lot of outliers. You're not wrong. So they Windsorized them. Why did they Windsorize them? And why did they...
They don't explain anything else about the outliers. They just said that. They just said that's how they classified them. But for me, that's one of the problems in the sleep science, right? It's like, oh, those guys. And it, I don't know, when I did, you know, sleep lab, and research is different, obviously, but when you measure someone's sleep, you're not going to be like, ooh, this wake was abnormal, I'm going to remove it out. You know, it's a little bit weird to me. And if we go back to the numbers of the night sleep and the length, if we look more like clinically, right, you go from 9.5 hours to 9 hours and 50 minutes, it's not huge. I mean, it's not a huge difference. Not.
Yeah, no. I mean, yeah, I was going to bring that up too, but it's significant in the statistical sense, but it's significant in the sense that it is making a difference to the baby, to their outcomes, to their development. Is it necessary and needed? Is that sleep that they, had to have? That's and one that's big sort of question that I had. And when you're talking about such small numbers, you know, and we'll probably get to a lot of other parts of the paper in soon, but... you know, for me, it really raised a lot of questions about what the benefits are, particularly when, and this was also, I feel, not given much weight, but, you know, parents reported that they find modified and unmodified extinction hard. And, you know, so let's also talk about the other outcomes and overall what the sort of the benefits are and if they outweigh.
Yeah, I agree. And all I think so for anyone who's listening who's not a scientist, I think we really need to make a difference between statistical significance and clinical significance. So it's like they found a difference. And I mean, 3.6 awakenings and 4 awakenings, clinically, what's the difference? Is it, you know, is it 3? Is it 4? And does that make a huge difference for parents? Because, you know, I'm sure, Jess, you agree, but when we work with families who may have more, you know, significant issues, it's not going to be 3-4 awakenings. It's going to be 10-15 awakenings. And so here I also have another problem with this paper, because they talk about improvement, but they never say what it is. Like, how did they measure improvement? Was it dropping by 1 week? Was it dropping by 3 weeks? Like, what's the improvement before and after this methodology exactly? Like, I don't know. Did you find this somewhere? Because I couldn't.
I'm still trying. So you guys are going so fast and I'm trying to keep up. So what I'm currently trying to do is trying to figure out how to calculate an effect size for these statistics that they are reporting, because there's one thing to say that, you know, it's significant, but because we're looking at over 2000 participants with an average of 11 to 12 observations per participant, because there is an average of 11 to 12, somewhere in between 11 and 12 nights per infant. And what they did was they used the generalized estimating equation, which takes into account that longitudinal data. So they have 12 times 2000 observations, which is about 24,000 observations. That is, that's huge. That's a monster. So the significance values don't necessarily tell us as much as the effect size would. So I'm trying to figure out, because they don't report an effect size anywhere in this paper that I can see of the significance. And I'm trying to figure out if the Wald value that they report is the significance value, is like an effect size value, like when you do a multi-level mixed model, the beta is actually a magnitude like indicator, or whether the Wald is simply like a F value, like in an ANOVA. And then you have to go and figure out what the effect size is with like a Cohen's D or something. I'm so sorry to everyone who's listening to this right now and is getting bogged down hard with all of the stats stuff. But when you have a paper with this many participants and these significant findings, there should be effect sizes reported in this. And it's either our lack of knowledge on the way that this statistical analysis works, or it's the author's faux pas with not including it, which is not uncommon. Effect sizes aren't very, like, aren't always reported, and it's a problem that we're trying to fix in research. So anyways, Jess, you look like you were looking at something. Do either of you know anything about this test and whether we can calculate an effect size for it?
I was trying to, but I haven't got to that answer.
Okay.
So I was wondering, just you said that they had an average of 11 nights per participant. I didn't write that down. I thought it was like about 3 nights.
No. So there was an exclusion criteria that said that participants had to have at least 4 nights.
At least 4 nights, yeah.
Video data, but that the average number of nights per participant was about 11. I remember reading that and then being like, oh, weird. But then I read further along and it said that there was an average of 11 nights per participant. So that was fine.
I went through the exact same process. I was like, 4, that doesn't seem great. Oh, yeah, that's a pretty good mean, nearly 12.
There's a lot of other really confusing things about this paper. So you know what we're going to do? We're going to step back from the effect size issues for a second. And we might drop in later in the feed or update next journal club. I don't know, but it's not the time to try and figure out how to get an effect size, an odds ratio by the sounds of it, for a Wald test. And what we're going to do instead is we're just going to step through the paper in and of itself. So let's just stop confusing everyone who's listening. You guys don't need that from us right now. And you know what we're going to do before we even step through it? We're going to go to the title page. We don't usually do this, but because this is a funded paper by Nanet, which is a company, an organization that sells products for infant sleep in cribs, it seems important for us to walk through who the authors are to kind of evaluate whether there is a conflict of interest or bias. Because that's something that we generally do actually do. So the first author is Michelle Kahn. I don't know if I'm saying that right. Her name is M-I-C-H-A-L. Apologies, Michelle, if that's not how we say your name. But essentially, Michelle looks at her research interest is in, she's a postdoctoral fellow, which is what I am. At the College of Education, Psychology and Social Work at Flinders University, Australia. Her research focuses on evidence-based treatments for pediatric sleep-related problems and anxiety, as well as on parental tolerance for infant crying and its links with sleep development. So what this tells us is that she does work in the pediatric sleep domain. She focuses on sleep problems, which is not your generic, like, standard baby that wakes throughout the night. So her approach and her view is going to be from more of a problem medicalized kind of lens, and that's perfectly fine. It's just good to know where her approach is from. And she's also focused on parental tolerance for infant crying, which means that she's really focused on the parents' experience of whatever behavioral sleep interventions and sleep problems occur rather than on the infant, which is also fine. It's just good to know these things. The next author is Natalie Barnett. Natalie Barnett is the scientist at Nanet. So she is the member of Nanet. She is a PhD, so that's awesome. The funding came from Nanet. And so it says that the support was by Nanet Research Grant to Flinders University, which is where Michelle works. Michelle, Natalie, and Michael Gradizar, who is the third author, all serve as consultants for Nanet.
Shall we mention what Nanet is, just in case some people don't know?
Yeah, so Nanet is the smartest baby monitor is how they market themselves on Instagram. So I've got the Instagram page up here. They say they use tech, experts, and real personalized data to help families stay connected and get better sleep from anywhere, anytime. I opened up their Instagram page to get a sense of where they kind of sit on the infant sleep spectrum, because it tends to vary. And this is a US company, and the US perspective, the medicalized, like the medical arena and their view of infant sleep in general, even just normal infant sleep, is one that emphasizes independent sleep, that emphasizes any wake as a problem, and encourages sleep training. So this is a US population that kind of comes from that background. And that is seen in the number of people that actually engaged in behavioral sleep interventions, such as modified and unmodified extinction. So I was really surprised by those numbers, and I'm going to pull them up here just before we get back into who these authors are. So 756 parents, no, that's not the right one. Hold on 2 seconds. Here it is. So 42% of parents in the final sample implemented modified extinction, which is FERBA. So that's 893 parents. 578 parents, 27% of the sample, implemented Cry It Out, which I was very surprised by because I thought Cry It Out was basically dead. I didn't realize that it was still being practiced in this way. That's where you put the baby in the room, close the door, and don't come back until the morning. And that was, so there was 27% of participants in that sample that did that, as opposed to only 210 parents, 10% of the sample, that did the parental presence, which is where they just kind of stand there and don't touch the baby. And then there was 36% of the sample, 756 parents, who did nothing. So they were the second highest number of people in the study. So FERBA parents were 893, and then it was no intervention at all was 756, and then it stepped down to a few hundred, a 578 for unmodified extinction. So that tells you a little bit about the parents who are using the monitor. So this is not an impartial sample. This is a sample that uses the Nanette monitor. These participants were recruited based on whether they had the Nanette monitor at home. And so it tells you that the people who need these monitors and want them might be more biased towards one approach in parenting and infant sleep than another. We don't know, but we have to take that into account. Now, the final author on the paper is Michael Gradizar. So Michael Gradizar is a professor and director and clinical psychologist at the Child and Adolescent Sleep Clinic at Wink Australia at Wink Sleep in Australia, and the head of sleep science at Sleep Cycle in Sweden. Dr. Gradizar has specialized in the treatment of pediatric sleep problems since 2006. He has provided training to over 420 psychologists throughout Australia on the treatment of pediatric sleep disorders and published several research studies evaluating the treatment of insomnia and circadian rhythm disorders in children, adolescents, and adults. So Michael Gradizar focuses on sleep disorders and sleep problems again. So really it's a medicalized approach. He also has an app called Sleep Cycle, which is focused on improving parent sleep. So we really are focusing here on how to improve parent sleep. He sells at Wink a bunch of courses all relating to teen and adult sleep improvement. And he still has that clinic, which is focused on child and adolescent sleep. So these are the authors, and this is the lens through which they're conducting the research. And this is their conflict of interest and bias. But that is, it's fine for us to know that. You can still be very objective and unbiased when you do these things. Okay, I'm sick of talking. Who wants to go through the next part of the methods?
I just wanted to say also that the Nanette, and they talk about this a little bit, but it's quite expensive.
Is it?
So if you want, well, it's between $200 US dollars and $330 US dollars. So it's not one of those, you know, cheap kind of monitors. So, and it does influence also the kind of population who would buy it, obviously, who has enough cash to spend that kind of money. But they do mention it, you know, and they do mention it at the end, the kind of population that they have and, you know, the social status, etc. I wanted to talk about the methodology, and I think Jessica agreed with my observations when we were discussing just before. So this objective video somnography, so I have issues with that as someone who did score sleep manually. So they do mention their own paper, and that's the thing. It's not even a paper. So it's a poster presentation, and that's what they reference to, saying that it was reliable.
Pick that up.
Yeah.
I didn't investigate what that N7 study was.
It's not published. And so what's interesting is that in the paper where we are, they cite their other paper, but the other paper is not the validation of the video somnography method. And in the other paper, they say it has been previously validated against polysomnography. So this very strong wording, knowing that it has not, it was just a poster presentation. Whereas here, and I feel like that's the reviewers doing, they actually say, despite this promising preliminary evidence for validity, the current lack or larger peer-reviewed studies evaluating this measure's performance suggests that the derived data should be considered exploratory. So here they're a bit more honest, and it really feels like they added this sentence in. I don't know if you felt that. It was like, ooh, yeah, we can't. And so I went back to look at the latest paper who talked about pediatric video somnography and what they say. And basically what they say about this versus, you know, actigraphy or polysomnography, which are actually validated to look at the sleep. This study provides preliminary support for the use of an auto video somnography system to index sleep onset and morning rise time only. So it is not reliable for wakes or anything like that at the moment. Oh, no. It's supposedly just reliable for knowing when the child falls asleep and when the child wakes up. And I think this is really important, especially because we were already discussing, you know, the 3 and 4 wakes. And it's like, how many wakes, you know, were the child actually doing? And since it's not even a published paper and it's a poster, I couldn't find anything about this automated algorithm, magical thing, formula that actually measures the kid's awakening. So for me, there's already a big problem there because they rely all of their objective measurements on this thing that's not really validated. Yes, maybe.
Yeah, I feel you on that one. I didn't realize that it was a poster presentation. I'm looking at it now. Is it a poster presentation or is it a paper? Because it says page 134.
It's a poster presentation, no?
Oh, okay, so here's the thing with, it depends whether it's engineering or not, because I also worked in engineering. Conference presentations can also be peer-reviewed published proceedings, so I just need to clarify that first. I mean, it sounds pretty bad.
But they say themselves that it was not peer-reviewed in this paper where we're at. So they said, despite this promising preliminary evidence for validity, the current lack of larger peer-reviewed studies, blah, blah, blah. And then they also mentioned that this was validated on 7 children, which is going back to this kind of preliminary poster presentation kind of study.
Yes and no. I hate to be the bearer. Like, I hate to be that person that argues. But because if this is a computer science paper, a user study with 7 participants is not invalid. It's just that's the norm in the field. So there is a paper right up here. I don't see an actual publication though. So usually when I publish in conferences, because I published in engineering conferences as well, it usually has a PDF download that looks like a normal publication. And this just looks like a brief summary, although it says article. I don't know. This is very confusing. It has a DOI. It doesn't necessarily say whether it's been peer-reviewed. That would take more research to know if they have peer-reviewed every entry into the conference, because it sometimes happens. What it does say is...
But the conference was European Respiratory... It was not a computer conference. It was a respiratory conference.
Yes, but I don't know how it works in respiratory. I don't know how it works in medical conferences. To be totally honest with you, I don't know if it is more likely to be like a psychology conference, which is not peer-reviewed and is not published and treated as a publication, or whether it's more like the engineering field where it is treated as a publication and it is peer-reviewed. Because the proceedings are published, because this is published, I am erring towards the side that this is a publication. It's just a very, very limited one. It's a published abstract, essentially. This is an ERS sleep and breathing conference abstract. Yeah. No full text version is available. Further material to accompany this conference is available at ERS Education. I think that it might not be, but because we don't know enough, we can't make that call. But what it does say is that they compared, the specificity was higher for the camera than the actigraphy, but we can't see any of the data. The accuracy was higher for the camera than the actigraphy, but I can't say for certain whether seven infants is enough to clarify this. It definitely does need more information, but that's where we're at right now. So it is a bit complicated. It sounds like they've had to walk back their description of it a bit, whether that's their own doing and it just reads like someone else has asked them to do it, or whether it is reviewer promoted, doesn't really make a difference, because that's the purpose of peer review, is to make us explain our research and our claims a bit better. I've certainly been told to walk my claims in my research back. I'm currently in the middle of revising a paper that's been sent back to me for the second time, being told to be more gentle in my claims. So I feel that pain. But I think you are correct that all it really looks at is wakes and sleep onset. And I think that I read, there it is, an awakening is something that lasts a minimum of 3 minutes within the nocturnal sleep period. Mm-hmm. And it never really describes what an awakening is, looks like, just a number of them. So is it movement, or is it calling? Is it sound? Or is it removal from the cot or interaction with the cot? It doesn't really clarify. I don't know.
For me, it was only movement.
I think it's only...
Yeah.
It's a good question. It's based on the movement of the entire body rather than only the ankle or wrist, which is, you know, good. We want that. And computer vision is getting better to be able to do that. I do wonder whether, so they sell sheets which help the computer vision algorithm be more accurate because it uses the patterns as markers. I do wonder how many parents use that as opposed to just the standard monitor, but that's just, that should be variation. That's pretty randomly distributed across parents. Across groups, you would hope. So it shouldn't make too much of a difference. Let's step back.
Can we talk about some of the other measures that they use?
Yes. Mm-hmm. Well, before we talk about the measures, I really need to talk about the inclusion and exclusion criteria, because I'm very confused. Very confused.
Mm-hmm.
So there were parents included in the study if they met the following criteria. They were identified as the parent of an infant aged 3 to 18 months. And they completed survey items regarding behavioral sleep intervention implementation. They had to report that they had implemented a behavioral sleep intervention within the last 12 months. Now, what they then said next, so they had to have 4 analyzable nights of audio video somnography. Actually, no, stop. Go back. Sorry, I skipped past it. They report that they had implemented a behavioral sleep intervention within 12 months earlier than the survey completion. This is where I get confused, because there is an entire group of participants in this study who used no behavioral sleep intervention, yet this is saying that they were excluded. So I am very confused. Were they excluded or included? I do not know. Clearly they were included, but like, I don't understand.
I don't know. I don't have an answer to that one.
Welcome, friends listening. You guys are not the only ones confused by research, because sometimes research is very poorly described, even when you're very good at research. It's a fun time. The fun part, and this is the part that I think we all find great joy in. It made all of us giggle. Nights of auto video somnography were considered analyzable if infant sleep onset times were within the 4 p.m. to 12 a.m. range, sleep offset times were within the 4 a.m. to 11 a.m. range, and sleep duration was more than 5 hours. Yes, Jess, you have your hand.
I think I have an answer to your confusion before. So yeah. It would seem that because the age range was 3 to 18 months, it could be that they implemented the sleep training more than 12 months ago. And so if that were the case, then they were excluded. So it includes people who didn't implement sleep training, but out of those that did, it had to be in the last 12 months to reduce recall bias.
Yes, yes, that makes perfect sense. Amazing. Now let's talk about the elephant in the room, which is that the participants had to be, the nights of auto video somnography had to be considered analyzable if the baby was in the bed, full stop, it was in the crib, full stop, and if they were in there for 5 hours. I don't know about you, but most parents I know have their baby in their bed at some point in the night.
Especially Jess, between 3 and 18 months old.
So Jess, what does that mean?
Well, to me, it means that they've lost an entire kind of group of babies and parents who are more likely to parent in a certain way, are more likely to sleep in a certain way. Yeah, it really just kind of brings into question, yeah, what was lost through the loss of those babies.
So they do mention it in the discussion, which mm-hmm. I thought was good. So infants that spent less than 5 hours asleep in the crib during the predefined nighttime period were excluded from analysis, thus creating a bias towards good sleepers. So meaning crib sleepers, right?
Yeah, they were already good sleepers.
So I agree with what they wrote for that part. But yeah. And the thing is, it's for me, it's a little bit more relating to what they were talking about the parents, if they were more tolerant to crying, because if you have these moms who are, you know, kind of motivated to keep putting back their baby in the crib and hearing their baby cry over and over and over again through the night, for me, that would be the biggest factor that would say how long the baby's gonna go back in the crib.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. So I think something that we probably need to say here is we sound like it makes us sound like we think this study is pretty terrible. We don't. We absolutely don't think it's pretty terrible. We think it's actually pretty objective and unbiased. It's not reporting as many details as we would like, and things aren't as easily findable as we want them to be. Like, I couldn't find the appendix that they cited in the paper to figure out what parental presence was, but I went to a different paper and found it. So it's a lot more work and a lot more confusion. So it's leaving out a few key details, but that's not uncommon in research. Now, I think the reason that all three of us are pretty fired up when reading this study is because of the media exposure the abstract of this study has had and how Nanette has actually marketed it as well. They've talked about, they've just kind of taken the findings and they've disordered them. They've actually done, the authors, as far as I know, have done a reasonably good job of keeping it balanced and unbiased.
I think Laura particularly considering... I mostly agree with you. Like, I think that in a lot of ways this paper is objective in terms of it reporting what it found. Mm. Yeah. There's still... You know, it gets kind of complicated to me. I could kind of go on all day because there's so many influences that, you know, in the sense of the narrative that is chosen or the interpretation and the story that's written, because it's really building off the other behavioral sleep intervention research. And that in itself has also got a whole lot of other things. That's a whole thing. But there are so many other things that can be pulled out of this paper, in my opinion, and with my own, you know, biases and thoughts and views that I still think are also, you know, objectively looking at the research, but then, you know, coming up with a little bit of a different conclusion. So in that sense, like, they're not wrong and we're not wrong, but there are different ways to look at things and there are different things that you could talk about and different conclusions that you can make.
Absolutely. Okay, so... let's talk about some of the different findings then. We'll just move on now because we're getting really bogged down in details and we've been talking for almost an hour. So let's talk about the different details. Jess or Laura, one of you want to discuss the, let's just go through, I'm at table three, the auto video sonography results. Who wants to talk through all of that? I mean, we've already discussed it briefly. Let's just go through it and describe the differences between the groups and things like that, so that we have an idea of what the auto visio sonography has.
So back to the sleep duration. So that's what we were saying at the very beginning. It varied from, so 9.94 is actually nine hour and 56 minutes for the unmodified extinction. And for the parents who didn't do any kind of training, it was 9 hours and 37, but we did mention that apparently the graphs showed something different, right?
Slightly.
So, yeah, it wasn't as clear, yeah.
And so in terms of the nighttime awakenings, it went from 3.63 in the unmodified extinction. Modified extinction was similar. With the parental presence, it was 4.11, and then similar for the parents who did nothing. And here we already discussed a little bit, you know, the statistical difference and what it means clinically and how much three or four awakenings would make. Well, Jess, you actually kind of already summarized this. I guess we didn't really look at all the other parent report from the questionnaires, but what they said in the paper was there was no consequence of any of the kind of trainings on parent sleep quality, daytime sleepiness, depressive symptoms, and bonding is their conclusion.
Yes. Yeah, that was really interesting. So
a huge finding, right?
Well, yes.
To me,
no.
They didn't discuss it very much. Suddenly it appeared in the discussion.
Wait. I think there's a reason that this isn't as major as we think it is. So we're used to seeing these behavioral sleep interventions as a pretest, intervention, post-test, right? They look at the change of depression scores. They look at the change of sleep before and after those interventions. And so what this tells us is that the characteristics of each of these groups is really similar, and that whether you sleep train your baby or not, whether you let them cry it out or not, had no, like, on average, made the parents no different between each other. It doesn't tell us whether depression improved from pre to post test. It only tells us that later down the track, within 12 months of giving your baby some kind of behavioral sleep intervention or nothing, that all parents seem to be similar sleep quality, similar like sleepiness, similar depressive symptoms, and similar infant parent bond. It doesn't say how any of those things might have changed at an individual level. So it really is just looking at group level characteristics, which we can't say that much about because it's an average of a very large group and we're likely to find an average mean. And I don't find it likely that we would see systematic variation among these groups because we don't know if there is something specific about parents that choose cry it out over parents that choose no intervention at all in terms of their level of depression, their level of sleepiness or sleep quality, or parent-infant bonding. You'd be more likely to see those things come out of like a parenting style. Maybe authoritarian parents are more likely to use unmodified extinction, whereas permissive or authoritative parents might be more likely to use a different type of intervention or no intervention at all. So I think that it's an interesting finding, but I don't think it's massive because it doesn't tell us enough in terms of change.
So I'd agree with what you're saying, but I guess where I felt, you know, and maybe the word huge was a little much, but when sleep training is kind of is a, you know, pretty standard prescribed thing. The society that we're in Australia, you know, Kristen and I, at least in the US where these parents were, it's sort of, it's almost expected, you know, it's like a rite of passage of parenting and you should do this. So to me, when it's being recommended on a population level, then I did find it important to say that on a population level, we're not finding that it makes a difference to parent mental health, to parent sleep, which out of all of the arguments I've seen for sleep training, you know, especially on an individual level, I find that at least, you know, one that I can't completely discount, that if a parent is so desperate that, you know, what they need to do, and even if that is modified extinction and we're not sure what the risks might be, that in their particular case it could outweigh those, you know, the benefits could outweigh the risks for them. But that's not how sleep training happens. Sleep training happens on a massive scale in everyday families, day to day, sleep problems or not, mental health problems or not. And so viewing it in that context, I think, adds something.
Yes, I do think that the peer reviewer in me is going to come out now and say that we can't say that there is no difference or there is a difference, because that's a change score terminology. What we can say is that the groups of parents look similar, that they don't vary on average in terms of how poor their sleep quality is, how sleepy they are, how depressed they are, or whether they have a good or bad infant bond. And I think that's really important for people who do sleep train their infants to know that there is not necessarily a significant difference when it's such a big sample on impaired infant bonding, because I do know that that is something that many people worry about. And I had questions on TikTok about how they actually measured infant bonding. And it's actually a standardized validated measure. It's the postpartum bonding questionnaire, which is a self-report measure of the parent-infant relationship. It comprises 25 items, e.g. I feel distant from my baby, each rated on a scale from 0, never, to 5, always. So this is really about the parent's perception of the bond with the infant. Something else that could be really interesting to look at here is actually attachment styles, to see if it varies with attachment, but we've also seen that it doesn't. We've had those studies run before. It's a really hard thing to kind of navigate that one, but at least it says that there's no difference in between any of the groups in terms of parent-infant impaired bonding, though I would like to have seen some Bayesian analysis on these null findings, but because it's such a big sample, I am more confident that it is actually a null finding.
So one thing that did bother me a little bit in some of the media representation is that it is being talked about as attachment, and attachment and bonding are two different things. They're two very different things. And so conflating the two, and you know, presenting this as a finding that behavioral sleep interventions don't affect attachment, that might be true, but this study does not show that, you know, this study did not investigate that.
Yes. So for all of you guys listening at home, so you just heard that the parent bonding questionnaire is about how the parent feels towards their child. Attachment looks at the discrete behaviors a child makes in the strange situation when the mother leaves the room and re-enters the room, and classifies attachment based on four different styles of behavior. So the parent bonding questionnaire looks at the mother's attitudes towards their feelings with the child, whereas attachment looks at how the child responds, so how the child, baby, reacts when the mother leaves and comes back. So they are very different in that parent bonding is about the mother's perception, attachment is about the baby's behavioral expression. So they're very, very different in that respect. Okay.
I also thought it was interesting that out of all of these measures, they basically kind of summarized it as our findings further coincide with recent evidence for the safety of parental use of occasionally or even frequently leaving babies to cry it out, when I felt like the measurements were, you know, not really focused on the baby's function and like well-being. So it's like it doesn't affect the bond and the depression of the parents. Like, it's very parents focused. if that mm-hmm. makes sense. And then how did they come out and be like, ooh, you can leave your baby to cry, it's safe. I don't know, it felt really out of place in the
totally.
Paper.
I noted the same thing down. Like yeah. there's arguably, you know, the infant related outcomes are the awakenings or the, you know, supposed difference in sleep. But in terms of, you know, infant related emotional or developmental outcomes, there aren't any because parent-child bonding is not one. And that's the only one that could be construed that way, but isn't actually representative of that, meaning that it had no infant-related outcomes emotionally.
Yes, hey. Yes. So I've just looked really closely at table one, which might give us some more insight into these findings. So the first one is infant age. So there is a significant difference between the groups on infant age with the no behavioral sleep intervention group significantly younger than the other three groups. So the three groups that are all about behavioral sleep intervention were 10 months, 10.3 months, 9.7 months, and 9.2 months. And then the no behavioral sleep intervention group was 7.6 months old. So we are already going to see variation in the number of wakes and the length of time slept because of the age of the child. As children increase in age, those things reduce or lengthen. So that's interesting. But then the next one that I found really interesting is more stark, also significantly different, is room sharing with parents. Mm-hmm. Unmodified extinction babies shared their room with their parents 4.5% of the time. Babies that did modified extinction were 7.7% of the time. Out of 688 babies in the parental presence group, it was 21.9% of the time. So it sounds like those parental presence participants were in there even while their babies were crying because they didn't have anywhere else to go. They were present because they couldn't put them in a different room. And then for the no behavioral sleep intervention, 18.1% of babies were sharing with their parents. So that also gives us quite a significant insight into what might have motivated the infants to wake in the night. It could be the presence of the parents, the smell of the parents, the noises the parents make, the coming in and out of the room. What do you guys think about those two?
I wanted to come back 2 seconds on the age that you were mentioning, because to me, this also kind of says that we're not talking about the same sample, in the sense of, you know, in my more like coaching, sleep educator experience, you will get families who are not doing any intervention until later in the time. So you will have mm-hmm. even breastfeeding, bed sharing moms who do not know how to, you know, evolve from there eventually, and who will be like, okay, now I have to sleep train. So these mm-hmm. infants who are like around 7-8 months might go in the other groups later on. And so this age thing that you're mentioning is really, I think, kind of essential. And yeah, it's not a good comparison for sure.
It definitely puts some of the findings into question because it could be driven by other factors. Though in their generalized estimating equation, they did talk about including it as a covariate. And I just don't know enough about it to know how much it partialed the variance out for that effect. It's really hard to figure out what was and wasn't included in the data. And it doesn't look like they have open access data for us to be able to explore it and analyze the data for ourselves. One of the things that I'm currently doing, tomorrow I'm going to the University of Queensland to do a big open science presentation and workshop for everyone, where a lot of the things we talk about is the top guidelines for open science, which includes things like sharing data, sharing syntax for data analysis, and having it all open. This is harder to do when you have infant data, especially when it's proprietary data owned by Nanit.
Yeah, that would be probably the main thing.
Of course.
They would have an embargo on the data, I would imagine, that then the researchers yes. would need to apply to remove. And I mean, it could either be a long process or yeah. they just never will.
Yeah, there's a lot of reasons why it may not happen. to be posted publicly, but things like that would help us really read into it more, because all we really have to go on is what the researchers have said. And because it's the Journal of Pediatrics, I don't know what their attitudes are towards top guidelines, but I have a feeling that it's not a mandation that people look at their analyses and have an independent body replicate them. That's only very few journals have that at the moment, though it's increasing in prevalence now. So anyways, that's just an aside. What else did we want to look at? Infant age at implementation was roughly around the same for the unmodified, modified, and parental presence groups, but it didn't have any information about the non-behavioral sleep intervention, obviously, because they don't have an intervention at all. The intervention was implemented for 25 days in the unmodified extinction group on average. 25 days? Wait, what? Why did I forget about this? They let babies cry it out for 25 days. No wonder they thought that it was really difficult. Actually, no, they didn't. It was 4.16, which is about the middle of the difficulty scale. Wow. Guys, what do you think? I feel like we've been told that sleep training, especially cry it out, takes 3 days. What is 25 days?
It depends if it's gentle, Kristen.
But no, this is unmodified extinction. Yeah, this is cry it out.
Yeah. I still feel like even those, honestly, I wish they had given more details, because I'm pretty sure even the unmodified extinction there's a big variability inside the sample. Because I don't know. I wish I had had more details on that too, like exactly the methodology that they included for each group. I'm not surprised by the 25 days, just, you know, knowing from experience that, you know, most kids are going to resist.
Yeah. I don't know, on social media, they always talk about taking 3 days for cry it out, 2 weeks maximum for getting your baby to sleep through the night. And for modified extinction, which is this standard sleep training package that people sell you, it's like they even call it gentle sleep training. But if it's gentle sleep training, if they use the word training, it's generally going to be FERBA, which is modified extinction. And that was 31 days to implement. And it was 9.6 days before they saw any improvement. Whereas when you read the comments and the feedback on Instagram stories of sleep trainers, they have these like comments and shared stories saying like one night and it's changed everything. Like on the first night there was a bit of crying, but the second night there was no crying. This does not say that. This study does not say that at all.
So, yeah, I mean, I'm not really surprised in the comparison that you drew, because, you know, when you're trying to sell sleep training, you're probably not going to post a DM that says it took 31 days of crying. I mean, yeah, that makes sense. So, but I think in terms of speaking to, you know, what this might be telling us, I would just say like there's not very much talk about or attention given to the fact that different babies are different and their temperament is a very large indicator of the sort of success in terms of how you would define success in sleep training. And, you know, it really is maybe very fast and effective for a very small percentage of babies that have a very particular temperament and sort of tolerance for being left to cry and for all those sorts of things. And that's something that's not widely talked about enough, I think, in terms of letting parents know that, you know, these might be your options and these might be, but this is the wide variation in experience. And, you know, that's sort of normal and yeah.
So again, I think it's interesting because I really want to know what improvement means. Sorry if I go back to that, because I want to know. And also, as you're saying, so like if it takes 31 days, maybe no parents want to do it instead of 2 days. Mm-hmm. But also, some people would consider that 3 to 4 weeks is not success either, like because sleep training is basically telling you that you're done, like your baby will sleep through and never wake again. So same here, this for me is more realistic and saying, see, those kids between 3 and 18 months still wake 3 to 4 times. And they're considering that this is a success if they say that there's an improvement. The other thing is, I was actually surprised because they did say a tiny, tiny sentence about different kids. So in the discussion, they say, although understanding whether one approach is more effective than others is important, it's also crucial to consider whether there are certain cases in which one approach may be more appropriate than others. It's only a little sentence, but still I was kind of appreciative of being like, okay, you're kind of going in the way of like some kids might need certain things and some things some kids might not, which goes with, you know, our kind of my perspective. And I think you guys agree that, you know, if sleep training works within one night, it means that the schedule worked for the baby. It's not about the method.
Definitely. I find that this data here, potentially this data here, is the most important and interesting thing that we should share with parents widely. Like, this should probably be, like, I'm sure you guys are already like raring to like put up an Instagram post saying like, the data does not reflect the common claims that sleep trainers post on social media. The data tells us that you can implement these, and you if you want to, that's absolutely your prerogative, and it could be the right thing for your family. But here's the information you need to know, because if you don't know this, you might be less likely to proceed with that intervention, because you were told it would take 3 days and it took 25. So knowing that the average length of implementation took X, knowing that how long it took to see an improvement was 10 days, knowing that the change or improvement that you can expect is one less wake a night and 20 minutes more sleep might actually be really interesting things. Now, we can't just say that because those are averages. On average, those are the differences, and different children do different things, and these aren't change scores. But on average, that's how much these groups are varying. So it kind of takes people off of a pedestal that were like, I sleep trained my baby, therefore I'm doing the best for their sleep. How could you not sleep train your baby? You are destroying their sleep. Like you're ruining their cognitive development and stuff. It really undermines all of that rhetoric and posturing, because it's saying, you know, there's very little difference between the babies who were sleep trained and those who were not. And there's very little difference between the parents.
And we're not talking about 12 hours night either, shall I say? Like,
yeah, no, is that nine? Like, what is it, 9 and 10? No, not even.
Let's say 10 hours, but this is also more towards what we tend to say, that the total sleep time is not quite the 12 hours a night.
It's not 7 to 7.
Wow.
I love this study. You know what? I really like this study. I feel like it gives a really realistic perspective of what average sleep looks like for babies that are sleep trained and those that are not. I think that's really valuable. So I think that's awesome.
I agree.
Thank you, Nanet. Thank you, Michelle Khan. Who else is it? Michael Gratizar and Natalie Barnett. This is excellent. We love it. It tells us many things. What are your final thoughts, guys? Because we've been talking for too long.
Yeah, we really have. I think there was just a lot more to unpack there than I even kind of got on my first or second read through on my own. My sort of overall takeaway was that, it didn't really seem super compelling in support of sleep training as being particularly effective at the main thing that it's sort of designed to do and sold to do. And so really depending on individual factors in, you know, a parent and a family, then I think, you know, like you were saying, Kristen, really with those results, is like, it's really important to know that, because, you know, if you do find it really hard, if it feels like it goes against everything that you feel is right, then, you know, I think understanding what the possible or average, you know, benefit is likely to be is a piece of information that you need to have in deciding whether or not it's something that you want to do.
So for me, I think there's a few things, but I wish, so they did mention and they said that people start kind of these sleep training techniques as early as 1 month old, and it sounded like they were not agreeing with that, which for me is a good thing. Mm-hmm. I wish they had mentioned, you know, the more safety, real safety, including SIDS, which is like, you know, we should have an eye on the kids. And I guess that's also what the NANET is for, I suppose. They also mentioned, they were kind of critical, I felt, with like people doing sleep training, not in a, I guess, sleep training school, like that, you know, people should do it more with supervision. And I would, I would argue that if people wanted to sleep train their kids so young, then I would rather they are in a clinical space and watched to make sure that nothing happens to them, even though, again. And so the last thing I would say is they kind of use these terms, real world settings and naturalistic kind of environment, talking about the crib. That's the one thing that I have a problem with. Most kids will end up in their kids, in their parents' beds. And it's completely fine. And they even talk about it. They even say lots of people are room sharing. Actually, did they even mention bed sharing? I don't know. I wish they had talked more about breastfeeding, but that's a big problem. Mm-hmm. Also in the research, like, you know, it probably was a tick box. Did you ever breastfeed, even if it was one day breastfeeding, as opposed to more? Because that would also affect, you know, even just the mom's well-being and all that kind of stuff. But basically, you know, parents need to do their best. And I wish the reality of the infant sleep, as shown in this paper, was more out there and not just like, you can sleep train, it's all safe, all good.
Yeah, I will say that breastfeeding was significantly associated with every single measure. So there is that to consider. It just doesn't say how it affected it in total. So, yeah, that is interesting. That is probably all we've got time for, though. And here's a really fun note to end on. I was just checking my Instagram DMs and someone was like, hey, Kristen, what do you think of this news article? And the title is Journal of Pediatric Study Finds Baby Sleep Training Safe and Vital to Stopping Infants' Insomnia. And as we've just discussed, it doesn't stop infant insomnia. It's not vital. And we don't really know if it's safe because nothing really told us that. All it's really told us is that that person misread the abstract and then put it on the internet. And they are a reporter for the West Australian. So that's ours. That belongs to us. That's great. Anyways, what a wonderful note to end on. Thanks for joining me, Laura and Jess. I'll catch you guys in the next one, which will probably be in the new year. Bye.
Thank you.
Bye-bye.